from deep inside your radio.
Truncated beep. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, from your nation's capital, Washington, D.C. And does it mean anything when you're going by an office, a multi-story office building currently under construction, although all the floors, you know, the concrete pads for all the floors are in place, that some of the vertical pilings between the floors already aren't vertical? Is that cause for, would you be leasing space in that building, on that floor? I don't know, I'm just asking. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a, beyond the bubble, and what a wondrous bubble it is, but beyond the bubble, over in the United Kingdom and in Australia, our allies in the coalition, our co-willings, there's all sorts of foo-foo this week about revelations. I know, sit down for this, that the United States and its allies, including France and Russia and, you know, people who were our allies and are our allies again but weren't our allies then, were bugging each other, and Hans Blix and Richard Butler, head of the UN Weapons Inspection Program, in the run-up period to the Iraq War. Oh, my goodness me. Now, yeah, there's a lot of feigned outrage and surprise, mock horror, at the idea that this would be going on. To me, it's sort of like, well, yeah, sure we'd be bugging them. We know where they are. We know their phone numbers. That's the easy one. You know, if I knew that we were bugging bin Laden, now that would be surprising, you see, because we don't know what. But that would be a good idea, maybe, don't you think? Instead of bugging our friends and Hans Blix and Kofi Annan, who has said, well, if they were doing it, they should stop. That's that old veiled fist of the UN. Back at work, stronger than ever. And ladies and gentlemen, another also big news beyond the bubble this week, especially in the United Kingdom. Much controversy about whether the war was legal. A former senior government, British government lawyer, Elizabeth Wilmshurst, former deputy legal advisor at the British Foreign Office, revealed in a statement that she'd quit her job on the eve of the Iraq War because she disagreed with the Attorney General's advice that the war was legal. She was a member of the Foreign Office's legal team for only 30 years. Her resignation shocked many in the British government at the time, but it received little attention as the war got underway. I did not agree that the use of force against Iraq was lawful, she says. There are reports in the British papers that the British military refused to move against Iraq unless they received an ironclad assurance from the British Attorney General that the war was legal, assurance which at the time he had not yet given. This was about 12 days before the war began. And a report in the British press that what pushed the British Attorney General to make an unequivocal finding that the war was legal was pressure from the United States. Fortunately, of course, questions of legality of war don't bother us. We're not talking about it. Doesn't seem to be bothering it. That didn't seem to be bothering us at the time. Did John Ashcroft weigh in? I didn't hear. And the other neat thing that's going on outside the bubble, we know that the WMDs now have been found to have been non-existful. Now comes a report in a British magazine, The Spectator, casting grave doubts over, I think, everybody's favorite horror story before the war began, that Saddam or one of his fiendish sons fed their enemies into a shredding machine just to hear them scream. Apparently, that's another one of those single-sourced stories from a guy who knew a guy who heard from a guy. It never actually has been confirmed. Which basically, ladies and gentlemen, just raises the question after all of this. Did Saddam really exist? Hello, welcome to the show.
Early in the morning, I was in my bed. My baby turned and kissed me on the top of my head. Made me breakfast, sent me on my way. Kissed me on the lips and said, have a nice day. She had me right where she wanted. Yeah, I was in a train. She said, ain't nothing wrong with Texas, but I really love to go to France. You know, I would do most anything, but I'm still making payments on her wedding ring. I went to my employer, Mr. Hayes. I said, working like a mother, how about a doggone raise? He said, money's tight. You know there ain't no change. I said, won't you reconsider? For my baby wants to go to France. I see us walking along the Champs-Élysées, exchanging kisses in a small French cafe. Wake up, mama, don't you fret. I found two cheap tickets on the internet. We leave on a Monday for 2 whole weeks. All we have to do is just eat and sleep. Had her right where I wanted. Yeah, she was in a train. I said, ain't nothing wrong with Texas, but you and I are going to France. Baby, ain't nothing wrong with Texas, but you and I are going to France. Part of the France.
Oh, you know that I'm all smiles, darling? You'd be too if you knew, darling, all of my smiles were for you. I'm all chills, darling, through and through. But my cold hands, darling, warm to the touch of you. Rain hasn't fallen for days now, but rainbows are filling my skies. My heart must have painted those rainbows shining before my eyes. Can't you tell that I'm in love, darling, deep and true? With guess who, darling, someone to live for, beg, steal, and die for, eat humble pie for, fly to the sun and the moon and the sky for, someone to dance with, laugh with, and cry for, and that someone is you, baby, your baby, oh.
Yeah.
from the other edge of America, from the home of the beast, the one that the conservatives keep trying to starve. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to another edition of Le Show. I don't see any homeless people here. They must have sent them all out Santa Monica way. Ladies and gentlemen, last week's program, as I advised you at the start, was recorded a day or two in advance. Well, 2 days. What am I? I'm in Washington 18 hours. I'm already talking like a politician. A day or two in advance. No, 2 days. What are you doing? So I didn't share this with you last week on the Let's Get Scared segment of the program, but just to let you know that it did get published and it's been going around the internet. Climate change over the next 20 years could result in a global catastrophe costing millions of lives in wars and national disasters. A secret report suppressed, well, not released, let's put it that way, by U.S. defense chiefs and obtained by a British newspaper, The Observer, warns that major European cities will be sunk beneath rising seas. Hey, that's the old Europe. Britain is plunged into a Siberian climate by 2020. Not the show. Is that why Barbara Walters is leaving? No. A nuclear conflict, mega droughts, famine, and widespread rioting will erupt across the world. That's not good. The document predicts abrupt climate change could bring the planet to the edge of anarchy as countries develop a nuclear threat to defend and secure dwindling food, water, and energy supplies. The threat to global stability vastly eclipses that of terrorism, say the few experts privy to the contents of the report. Disruption and conflict will be endemic features of life, concludes the Pentagon analysis. Once again, warfare would define human life. In other words, the whole world would be like Haiti. The findings, of course, contradict the Bush administration, which has repeatedly denied that climate change even exists. Of course, I now wonder if Saddam Hussein even exists, so or even. About the middle of the week, two of the authors of the report went public to say, it's not as dire as the press reports make it sound. So, but there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Now, why are we, you may have read the reports or heard them this weekend, that the U.S. and the U.K. are running a new operation, a new serious, we're getting serious about finding bin Laden. Hey, it's an election year. Not for him. He's got his job. Why, aside from that point, why now? Why not earlier? Says another British newspaper, The Guardian. Attempts to find the fugitives, bin Laden and his aides, last year were hindered by a lack of special forces soldiers, most of whom had been deployed in Iraq. Gee, wasn't that what the opponents of the war were saying, is that it was defraying something, distracting us, that was it, from the war on terrorism? Yes, it was. Continuing with the report here, and the failure of Pakistan to cut off escape routes by closing its border with Afghanistan. Well, now we know that that's hard to do. We know it's hard to close the U.S. border with Mexico, so figure how hard it is to close the Pakistani-Afghani border, because there's mountains in there. But just checking, Pakistan is still our friend, right? Their defense chief sold nuclear secrets to North Korea, Libya, and Iran, and they didn't close their border with Afghanistan to help us find bin Laden. But they're still our friends. Just checking. Just making sure, because, you know, this friendship thing, it's so volatile. A soldier serving in the British Army reignited the controversy about how much equipment British troops had going into Iraq, claiming he and his men had been issued with just 5 bullets each for the entire conflict. I just write that off to optimism. The unnamed soldier who said he came under fire several times on the front line in southern Iraq told a British television network, Channel 4 News, "We had 5 rounds each to defend ourselves. I actually crossed the border with 5 rounds. The magazine held 30 separate bullets, but I was issued 5 to last the entire hostilities of the war. We came under fire in Umm Qasr 3 or 4 times, not fire, it was more like ricochets." You know, there's been controversy in Britain about the equipment of the troops and them having to borrow, well, steal boots from the Iraqis because they had the good boots. Let's get on the good boot. But ladies and gentlemen, now that it's been unleashed, the sobriquet terrorist is free floating and available for anyone who wants it. Example number one, Dateline Boston. The chairman of American International Group, the world's largest insurer, Tuesday called lawyers who oppose tort reform, those are laws that would cap the limits on liability judgments by juries, called those lawyers terrorists and said class action lawsuits are a blight on the United States. AIG Chairman Maurice Hank Greenberg's remarks. Now, do I call him Maurice or Hank? Some people call him Maurice. Came a day after, we'll say what a day after came after in a minute. In remarks to business executives in Boston, Greenberg likened the battle over reforming class action litigation to the White House's war on terror. AIG insures corporations against multi-billion dollar claims of damages in asbestos lawsuits. Well, why would that give him a vested interest in the controversy? It's almost like fighting the war on terrorists, he called Boston College's chief executives club. I call the plaintiffs' bar terrorists. That drew a swift rebuke from the Association of Trial Lawyers of America, which called his remarks an insult to the American people and the American Constitution, not to mention John Edwards. But that's not all. As you'll learn, ladies and gentlemen, as we cue up our copyrighted feature, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
So many apologies, so little time. Education Secretary, this is the member of the Bush cabinet, Rod Paige, called the nation's largest teachers union a terrorist organization during a meeting on Monday with U.S. governors. The White House said he later apologized. Paige made the remark while discussing the federal No Child Left Behind law with governors at the White House. In the context of saying the National Education Association was not being cooperative with No Child Left Behind, he called them a terrorist organization, said Democratic Governor Jim Doyle of Wisconsin. Paige later said it was an inappropriate choice of words to describe the obstructionist scare tactics the NEA's Washington lobbyists have employed against No Child Left Behind. I also said, as I have repeatedly, that our nation's teachers who have dedicated their lives to service in the classroom are the real soldiers of democracy. I should have chosen the words better. It doesn't actually say sorry, but it's dripping with regret. A researcher for a high-profile Sacramento, California public relations firm mistook the local Dublin, that is in California, for the one in Ireland, contributing to a mass mailing that attacked Assembly candidate Tom Pico as a world traveler at taxpayer's expense. The mailer mistakenly claimed Pico took taxpayer-funded junkets to Ireland as the mayor of Pleasanton, which is kind of near Dublin. As a furor erupted about the mailer, David Townsend, founder and president of Townsend, Raimundo, Bessler, and Usher, a high-profile Sacramento public relations firm, said the firm will send out another mailer immediately apologizing to Pico. It was an honest mistake. We do apologize. Antivirus firm F-Secure has apologized for sending the Netsky B virus to several thousand of its British customers and partners via a mailing list. The apology said, because of a human error, you may have received an email infected with the Netsky B virus that was relayed through our external email list server. The virus did not originate from our network. If you had up-to-date antivirus installed, the virus has been stopped automatically, and no further steps are necessary on your part. Wisconsin State Attorney General Peg Lautenschlager pleaded guilty to drunken driving Thursday and apologized to her family, law enforcement colleagues, and each and every citizen of the state for what she termed a terrible choice. Following an emotional news conference broadcast live to much of the state, she refused to answer questions about the incident in which she ran her state-owned car off Highway 151 Monday night. Regardless of the details of the incident, the bottom line is that I made the wrong choice, and for that I will take full responsibility. Oh, but there's so many more. How about this? U.S. Representative Connie Brown apologized to an assistant secretary of state for comments she made about white men, but refused to back down on her statement that President Bush's Haitian policy is racist. Brown, during a briefing on the Haiti crisis, said the president's representatives were a bunch of white men. She was speaking to Assistant Secretary of State Roger Noriega, a Mexican-American. After Noriega told Brown, who was black, He's still with me? That he resented being called a racist and branded a white man, she responded, "You all look alike to me," according to witnesses. Brown said Thursday her remarks were not directed at Noriega, but toward Bush policy. She sent Noriega a letter to apologize. A letter addressed to a 14-year-old British girl as part of a car company's marketing campaign has caused outrage. Disgusted parents alerted local police in Borehamwood, who investigated the complaint. Full of graphic sexual references, the letter was sent by Jaguar. It began, "Everyone has their weakness, so what might drive you wild?" and ended, "I'll send you a photograph next week." The letter was signed by a male employee with no explanation of why it had been sent. A Jaguar spokesman said the letter, followed by a photo, was designed to promote its new $75,000 sports car. "We apologize unreservedly for any offense and embarrassment that may have been caused to the girl or her parents," said the Jaguar spokesman. But there is more, so much more. A conservative member of parliament has been rebuked for refusing to apologize for a joke about 20 Chinese cockle pickers who died at Morecambe Bay in England. Anne Winterton was reported to have told an audience about two sharks swimming in the Atlantic. She's alleged to have said one shark turned to the other to say he was fed up chasing tuna, and the other said, "Why don't we just go to Morecambe Bay and get some Chinese?" Party leader Michael Howard said in a statement, "Anne Winterton's remarks about the tragic deaths in Morecambe Bay were completely unacceptable. I deplore them and I apologize for them on behalf of the Conservative Party." A market, and here's another advertising gimmick gone wrong. Jaguar, move over. A marketing gimmick aimed at lessening headaches ended up creating one. A Bossier City, Louisiana insurance agent mailed out 300 envelopes last weekend with a letter that stated, "Here's how to solve one of your biggest headaches." Employees at a mortgage company in Shreveport received one of those envelopes. When they opened it, they found white powder. They called the Shreveport Fire Department, who sent about 10 fire officials, including an investigator and members of the hazmat team. The white substance, a crushed Tylenol. Insurance agent Scott Welch sent out the letters, gluing the tablet to the top right-hand corner of the letter. Through the mailing process, it became crushed. "The more creative it is, the better. Anything that stands out from other solicitations, any kind of lumpy mail," said Welch. "I truly, sincerely apologize for all of it." Saying it will not happen again, Minnesota Senator Norm Coleman apologized to the Senate Ethics Committee for accepting a $1,000 campaign check in his St. Paul office. He said he made a rookie mistake in taking the check at the close of a December 12th meeting with the Minnesota Utility Contractors Association. Coleman returned the donation last Friday to the group's political action committee. It's okay to have your aides take a check in your office, but not you. See? A century after the fact, a legislature from Breathitt County, Kentucky, apologized for a long-past predecessor's role in enforcing segregation. In a brief speech on the House floor, Representative Teddy Edmonds tendered a heartfelt and humble apology to African Americans. He said he was motivated by the daily moment in Kentucky legislative history, a factoid displayed on legislators' computer screens. Thursday's moment was about the infamous Day Law of 1904, so named for its sponsor, Representative Carl Day. It prohibited white and colored persons from attending the same school and was aimed specifically at Berea College, which at the time was integrated. The college fought the law all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court to no avail. So, I lost one there. Got to be careful. Former Congressman Dick Armey is apologizing again. He famously referred to Barney Frank as Barney Fag a few years back and then said he was sorry he'd simply mispronounced the name. He's atoning for a verbal slap at Boston. In the new issue of Boston Magazine, he kicks himself for his comment after the city was chosen to host the Democratic National Convention. "If I were a Democrat, I would feel a heck of a lot more comfortable in Boston than, say, America." Army says, "I was way out of line. In fact, every visit I've made to Boston has been a pleasure." Every visit, Dick? Not even I can say that. Another apology on the civil rights front. "A moment in history," read Daryl Joy Walters while standing on the altar of the teardrop-shaped Mount Canaan Baptist Church. "Sunday, September 22, 1963, should not be remembered as the infamous day when a young black minister was beaten by policemen on the steps of Little Union Baptist Church." This also from Shreveport, but rather a day when inequality and injustice took a beating. Last Sunday night at Mount Canaan, the city of Shreveport presented civil rights activist Reverend Harry Blake with an apology for the beating he received at the hands of police in 1963. Couple more on the religious front. And doesn't it prove somebody has a sense of humor when Mel Gibson's movie comes out the same week the Catholic Church issues a report saying that priest child abuse was worse than previously believed, at least by Mel Gibson? No, at least by a lot of people. And did you notice who's a spokesperson for the group presenting the report on the priests? Bob Bennett, former President Clinton's one of his lawyers and brother of Bill. I didn't hear Bill talking about the priests, so. Denying that sexual misconduct by priests was ever acceptable, Monsignor Richard Snezek, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing his name, apologized for comments he made during last weekend that suggested otherwise. This is from Boston. Snezek, who was appointed temporary leader of the Diocese of Springfield after the bishop resigned amid sexual abuse allegations, said in an interview with the Boston Globe the sexual abuse scandal stemmed from a belief among some priests during the 60s, 70s, and 80s that sex with young men was okay. Let me be clear and unequivocal. I did not mean to suggest, nor do I believe to be true, that sexual misconduct in any context is ever acceptable, he said. Clearly, those who have preyed upon our children, preyed with an E, have justified their actions in many different ways, including the delusion that they, the abusers, were not harming the children when, in fact, they were causing great and long-term harm. I guess he's sorry. And finally, American Airlines has apologized to four nuns of Indian origin who were among six passengers prevented from reboarding a Dallas to Fresno flight after crew members... No, not finally. We got one more. After crew members complained of smelling sulfur inside the cabin. We have an apology from the airline. They say they will refund the fare, but Sister Tessie Pius says she and her colleagues want to put the matter behind them, says a spokesperson for Mary Immaculate School, which is... I'm over here. Which is where the four nuns work. Sister Pius had said earlier she felt humiliated the airline made the nuns feel like they were terrorists and hence being detained, she said. Sister Pius, the principal of the elementary school, was returning to Lemoore, California, after spending Christmas in Kansas. That can make you smell like sulfur. Once the flight reached Dallas, where they had a stopover, flight attendants complained they smelled something like sulfur, and the pilot ordered all the passengers to deplane. While the other passengers were cleared and allowed to reboard the flight, the four nuns and two other passengers were detained for about 6 hours and their bags were searched. The only explanation reportedly given to them by the airline staff was that they and the passengers were not comfortable taking them inside. It's all about your comfort, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, I'm just playing with the machines here. Don't worry about me. And finally, after the nation's top shock jock, Howard Stern, was yanked from a half-dozen Clear Channel radio stations this week, the company's top executive apologized to Congress for the raunchy material the stations have aired in the past and promised it would never happen again. John Hogan, president of 1200 Station Group, Clear Channel, told members of the House Committee on Energy and Commerce he was ashamed of material like that spewed by Bubba the Love Sponge. Yes. Why would you hire a guy named Bubba the Love Sponge if you didn't think that the show was going to be about sex? John. And the Howard Stern Show. We were wrong to air that material, Hogan said. I accept responsibility for our mistake, and my company will live with the consequences of its actions. Really? You going to sell some stations? How about Bill Clinton, who signed the Telecommunications Act in 1996, ladies and gentlemen? All you Clinton lovers out there. The act that allowed Clear Channel to own 1,200 stations. Bubba drew a $750,000 proposed fine recently from the FCC for indecent material and a $40,000 fine for record-keeping violations. Lawmakers grilled Hogan on his decision, wondering why he made it now since the shows have changed little over the years. I don't think he's changed his tune, said Hogan, but we've changed ours. We're going in a different direction at Clear Channel Radio. Rush Limbaugh weighed in. Those are the apologies of the week, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Rush Limbaugh weighed in, no pun intended, saying that he's in the free speech business, so he didn't like what happened to Howard Stern, even though he said he's never heard the Howard Stern Show. Ladies and gentlemen, bets? Put your money down. Rush Limbaugh has never heard the Howard Stern Show? Do you really think so? Is that possible? Is it conceivable to the mind of man or woman that Rush Limbaugh has never heard the Howard Stern Show? It's possible, I guess. Rush has his own problems, of course. He's fighting to keep his doctor's records in Florida from being made public by prosecutors who are still investigating that case of him and his OxyContin and his Vicodins, his hydrocodone habit. Let's just leave brand names out of it. And the prosecutors are threatening to make those medical records public, which would be a nutty move. It's just a few months since Rush came out of that 30-day detox program at an undisclosed location. And he might, at this point, be wondering if he was happier in than out. Maybe the show was even better.
Now, from inside an undisclosed treatment facility, the most listened to drug addict in America, on a Rush to Recovery.
Rush Limbaugh.
Greetings, counselors and tough love administrators all across the fruited plain of my mind. With talent on loan from God and half my brain tied behind my back just to make it fair for the other half, which is still loaded to the flipping gills, I am your avatar of broadcast turpitude, Rush Limbaugh. I want to thank Roger Hitchcock for taking the reins of my radio broadcast for the next little while, but here in the abstinence and broadcasting building that is my own cerebral cortex, we're embarking on the third of an unknown number of hours in the Limbaugh Institute of Advanced Conservative Revisionism, because, my friends, cold turkey is something far worse than what you eat the day after Thanksgiving. This is a situation that I take full responsibility for, even though it was caused by one stupid housekeeper with a big mouth. And I acknowledge that I have often treated those addicted to or just using drugs with great contempt and lack of compassion, advocating that they should be arrested, tried, and jailed. But my friends, and I wonder at this point if you are, my friends, those weak, undisciplined adherents of a degenerate lifestyle which threatened the very fabric of a God-fearing community had one very dramatic shortfall in their characters. They weren't me. But now, I'm not me either. I'm not a conventional air mattress. I'm totally adjustable. Environ-nutsos and feminazis, the homeless and the Democrats who would like nothing better than to have Saddam Hussein as their presidential candidate next year, I love you all. Now, even though I'm not on the air, this is pretty impressive technology, more impressive than the procedure that restored my hearing after it mysteriously disappeared with no connection to any overuse of prescription medication. We have a caller. I really don't know how this is working, but hello, you're on the AIB network.
Hey, Rush, it's Bill Clinton, long-time target, first-time caller.
President Clinton, I'm really not prepared for this. My mind's only on 3-second delay, so...
Don't worry, man, I'm not going to swear at you. I'm going to do something that's going to make you feel so much worse.
Mm-hmm. What's that, sir? Make me go on a date with Mrs. Clinton?
No, Rush. Mm. I'm going to feel your pain.
Oh, no.
And you're going to feel mine, because I'm going to play a saxophone solo over the telephone. Hold on.
Let's put this call on hold, and let me continue here with my exegesis of my position, because this is important. It's about the future of excellence, or the excellence of the future. And speaking of the future, my next book, I Told You I Was Right and I Was Wrong, is due out shortly after I am. I really should be working on it right now rather than engaging you, my friends of the brain cell audience, but I have always respected you and given you the benefit of your own thoughts, and now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I've told you this, they always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s, but that's what liberals do, and in my new book, I Told You I Was Writing, I'm a liberal too, because to tell you the truth, at the base of all this, ladies and gentlemen, has been a deep and abiding physical attraction to the late Bella Abzug. You can try her yourself in your own home for 30 days, risk-free. But this is what is gnawing away at the traditional values that hold this country together, my friends, and it is, in fact, my next book. I told you I was gnawing away at the traditional values that hold this country together. We've got another caller. And I want to pay a tribute to the engineers here at the Betty Ford Institute for Advanced Nonlinear Studies for putting it through. Hello, you're on the AIB network on Open Line Friday.
Rush, it's John Ashcroft, and it's Thursday.
Sure, I can't tell you how much I appreciate the call, but it is my hallucination, and that kind of obviates the conventional calendar approach.
Rush, I know you have a lot of time to fill, but I've got detainees to sort. I just wanted to call up and say God wants his talent back.
You know, Mr. General, I don't believe in coincidence, but I was just writing the other day in the Limbaugh Letter, the most consistently authoritative political newsletter in the history of the known universe, that I don't believe in coincidence. How about that?
Rush, this treatment stuff is the bunk. Why don't you just come over to the Justice Department and sing hymns with us every morning? Have you off the sauce in no time.
Well, Mr. General, thank you very much for the call. I think we're running out of time on the satellite. I am curious about one thing. How did you get this number?
I've been bugging Bill Clinton's calls.
John Ashcroft, ladies and gentlemen, taking the time to connect with the largest audience of time-release narcotic molecules in the history of broadcast access. We're just beginning this excursion into my new book. I told you I was white, but we got some bills to pay and some nausea to deal with, and then we will be back with more of the Rush Limbaugh program, so I urge you not to go away, and if you do, please take me with you.
Feel good to scream.
I should quiet down.
I could be about bird flu and mad cow. Oscar fever sweeping Hollywood.
And we've got the cure, a mega dose of extra access tonight for the end of February 2004.
Hi, everybody. I'm Mike DeVere.
And I'm Pat Mungo.
For some people, the Academy Awards are all about movies. But for the rest of us, the Oscars are about fashion, fashion, and more fashion. And when it comes to awards night style, the worse the better. At least for Joan Rivers, who works the red carpet with her daughter, Melissa. But even Joan doesn't dish without some prep.
Oh, look at that woman boarding the bus. She looks like she shopped at Lowman's after the fire. Oh, please. Oh, that girl going into Starbucks. She hasn't eaten since Ann Coulter had her last pie.
Joan and her crew go out on the streets of Hollywood for days before the big night, so the diva of dish can warm up.
You know, I guess I could do this sitting in this studio, just trashing the crew. But there's something about the electricity of being on the street. You're making fun of total strangers that just gets you up for the energy of Oscar night. At least I hope so. It's raining out here. Oh, my God, that woman coming out of the hotel looks like she's wearing a Mr. Blackwell gown. With Mr. Blackwell still in it. Yeah, we're good.
Joan and her daughter Melissa will be on the red carpet, rain or shine. Unless Melissa can get a date.
The recent controversy over Janet Jackson's Super Bowl halftime show has echoed all the way to the Kodak Theater in Hollywood. ABC has announced it's not broadcasting the Oscars live, but on a five-second delay, an Academy Award first. The Academy's not thrilled, but according to Bob Prendergast, the man with his finger on the button, they shouldn't worry.
I've been working the Oscars show since Billy Crystal was funny. And believe me, this delay is just to keep the guys in Washington from climbing all over the network. You know, these aren't like music people. Movie folks have to be paid a lot of money just to even get a little naked. So I'm just planning on sitting here and enjoying the show. You know, maybe if Howard Stern ever gets nominated for Private Parts too, I'll have something to do.
Because of the delay, Bob will know who wins the awards 5 seconds before the rest of the world. He says he might try to find a way to place some very fast bets on the internet during those precious seconds. But we bet he's kidding.
There's so much more to say about the Oscars, and we'll be saying it to each other, because that's it for now.
But Extra Access Tonight comes steaming back tomorrow with the results of our latest EAT poll.
We asked you whether you'd take a Jewish friend to see The Passion of the Christ, and the results will oy your vey.
Till then, so long from Culver City.
Isn't it a pity what you don't know when you're young? And isn't it a pity how we're headstrong and too high strung? Funny when you're old enough and wise enough, you laugh at stuff that used to make you cry. Cause everybody holds on to someone who'll do for fear of being lonely. So throw him over, Juliet. Cause he's a loser. He's a loser. He's no Romeo. And I know how long you waited, but you have to let him go, darling, before he turns you cold. Now I'm not the voice of reason, I just own all the things I
And I hate to see you suffer, but it's a lesson that must be won. I know that you're not ready to enjoy the view, 'cause you compromise yourself in this way. But everybody has a choice and has a voice, and it's better to be lonely sometimes. So throw him over, Juliet, 'cause he's a loser, he's a loser, he's no Romeo. And I know how long you waited, but you have to let him go, darling, before he turns you cold.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, another copyrighted feature, Tales of Airport Security. Hi, Harry, here's my tale. My husband and I visited Las Vegas for a few days and bought souvenir plastic swords for our kids at the Treasure Island Hotel. Each package was wrapped and glued together with big pictures of pirates, an eye patch, a lightweight plastic sword, and a little plastic dagger. When I went through security, the guard peered into my bag and looked at me suspiciously. I said that I had some aluminum cups in the bag and reached for them. The guard said in a loud voice, "Ma'am, step away from the bag." They couldn't believe that we were so ignorant that we thought we could bring these weapons on the plane with us. Apparently, no other tourists had ever bought pirate toys at Treasure Island. My husband hiked back across the huge airport and checked his carry-on bag, while I sat on the floor and waited, with all the security guards glaring at me. Eleanor. And I don't usually read tales of airport security from newspapers. I figure other people already know about them, but this one is just... it screams to be read. A screaming Dateline Kahului, Hawaii, a screaming, cursing passenger without identification got help from Kahului security officers at the airport to board a Pacific Wings flight last Friday. Pacific Wings security coordinator and chief pilot Robert McKinney said his staff felt pressured by a Wackenhut officer who identified himself as a Maui police officer and by an official of the Transportation Security Administration to accept a manufactured police report and pass the woman through security. McKinney says the airport's workers were badgered by three uniformed people who insisted it was okay. Pacific Wings became more alarmed when it turned out the alleged police report, used instead of proper ID, was bogus. And the company was even more alarmed when McKinney was told that Maui police issue, quote, very many, unquote, of these questionable reports that help people board flights. Maui Wackenhut manager Bill Meyer said Wednesday he would investigate, but he would be very, very shocked, two varies, if any of his 350 agents interfered with the boarding process. Will we hear more about this, ladies and gentlemen? I sure hope so. Tales of Airport Security, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And with that alarming news... hey, it's Sunday. on most of these stations. Let's get scared. That's going to conclude this edition of the show. The program returns at the same time over these same stations at this spot on the dial, that is to say. Over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 megahertz. Around the world via the internet at two different locations. On your computer whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. And starting tomorrow, Monday, the show is now available as a free download from audible.com at www.audible.com/theshow. Audible, the leading provider of premium spoken word audio on the web. And it'll be just like having more than five bullets in a war zone if you agree to join with me then. Would you? Alrighty. Thank you very much. Uh-huh. Email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, I can spell it, at interworld.net. The show internet services by Steve Mack. The show playlists almost always available at the newly refurbished harryshearer.com. Look to harryshearer.com for some new stuff for you to buy real soon. Yes, I know you've been aching for it. My thanks to Joe Arce at HRN here in Washington, D.C. for making today's Le Show unbelievably audible. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. From your nation's capital, so long, everybody.